I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, man, I wish someone would do a podcast of an introductory level overview of the federal income tax system. Well, guess what? Today's your lucky day because I'm going to do just that. And this is the 51st episode of the Retirement Planning Education Podcast.
Welcome to the Retirement Planning Education Podcast, where you can learn all about IRAs and Roth IRAs, employer retirement plans, taxes, Social Security, Medicare, portfolio withdrawal strategies, annuities, estate planning, and much more. And now here's your host, Andy Panko.
All righty. Thank you everyone for listening as always. Welcome back to the show. We are on our 51st episode. We made it past the half a century hurdle. Now on to the century mark. Looking forward to it. So anyway, so today's topic is I'm going to do an overview of the federal income tax system. Super high level, just walking through sort of broad strokes of how the system works, what's taxable, what's not, what are deductions, credits, et cetera. How do you finally end up in what your total tax obligation is for a year? And I'll talk a little bit about how to pay that tax. You may not exactly realize it, but many people often pay tax throughout the year and then just sort of have to true up anything additionally owed or refunded at the end of the year tax return time. So I'll preface this by saying that today I'll be talking just about the federal income tax system. Now, as far as state income tax, if you live in one of the states that does have income tax, some don't, for example, like Alaska, Florida, Texas, handful of others. But if you do live in a state that has income tax, the system can and likely will be different, at least to some extent. Now, generally speaking, many states that do have income tax, for the most part, piggyback off of the federal system. They sort of start with your federal gross income and then add or subtract certain things from it and what have you. But anyway, so today is just a federal system. Probably loosely applies to your state if you are in a state with income tax, but I'm not getting into state specifics here today. That'd be a whole separate can of worms. So today's just federal. Now, I will start by saying as well that I did a video on this, and this podcast is basically just the audio version of the video, though the video is a couple years old, so the facts and figures are outdated, but functionally very similar. So if you're interested in that, there'll be a link in the show notes to the YouTube video I did about I think it was called Overview of Federal Income Taxation. If you want to check that out in pretty picture form, today's the audio form. So, all right, let's get into it. The federal income tax system, federal income tax system is what's called a pay-as-you-go system, where you're supposed to be paying taxes as you earn or recognize income throughout the year. So hold that thought. I'll get back to that at the end when we talk about how to pay taxes, but I just want to sort of lead with that because that's kind of important to have in the back of your head as we go through this. At a super high level, the way that the system works is, think about it this way. By default, all of your income is taxable unless it's specifically excluded from taxation. So that's the easier way to think about it as opposed to thinking what is taxable. Think about, assume everything is unless it's specifically not. So at the very top level, and I should say you may have already known this, but this is all ultimately your federal income tax obligation and what your ultimate tax bill is all done through your Form 1040 tax return. When you do your tax return every year or have someone do it, whatever the case may be, it's ultimately the Form 1040, which is where all this stuff comes together. Now, the Form 1040 is constantly changing. If nothing else, aesthetically, it looks a little different every year, but it is a beast of a file, of a form, I should say. The form itself is only two pages, Form 1040, but there's lots and lots of additional and supplemental forms and schedules that may form part of the 1040. So the 1040, some of the line items there will reference other forms and schedules, which in turn may reference other forms and schedules. So it could be quite unwieldy pretty quickly if you have anything more than the simplest of income tax situations. But if you wanted to follow along, get yourself a copy of Form 1040. Just Google it. It'll be the first hit. The 2022 tax year form, as of the recording of this podcast in late November 2022, is not yet formally available. The draft form, it has been released by the IRS, but it's not official. The most recent official 1040 is a 2021. Now, functionally, they are quite similar. majority of the operative lines and items on the 2022 draft version are the same numbers, same rows as they were in 2021. So if you want to follow either 2021 or 2022, they'll both get the job done for purposes of glancing along on something during this podcast. So bringing it back, at a high level, assume all income you get is taxable unless it's specifically excluded from being taxed. And I should also step back and say that there is a formal tax code, the IRC or Internal Revenue Code, I think it stands for. You can Google that if you want to find it. It's super long, super difficult to read through. A lot of it isn't going to apply because it's not just you and individual income taxation. It's also corporate taxation, for example, which is a whole other animal. I don't know this for a fact, but maybe even more pages in code refer to that as opposed to individual. So definitely could be hairier. But today it's just individual income taxation. So again, coming back, start with all of your income. Assume it's all taxable unless it's specifically excluded. So what are some common things that are excluded? Tax-exempt interest. For example, if you own municipal bonds, a bond issued by a state or local government, for example, or municipality, the interest that those bonds pays is not taxable at the federal level, assuming you hold that bond in a regular, normal taxable brokerage account. If you own it in a quote-unquote qualified account, like an IRA or a Roth IRA, potentially a different story, but for just normal after-tax brokerage, normal brokerage account, interest you receive from municipal bonds is specifically excluded from being taxable at the federal level. Social Security benefits, if you receive Social Security, some or all, might be excluded from income. There's a complicated formula to determine how much specifically is excluded for income. Specifically, the formula says anywhere from 0 to 85% of your Social Security benefits may be taxable, which means at a minimum, 15% of your Social Security benefits are not taxable, and potentially up to 100% might be excluded from taxation depending on that formula. And that formula is based on the total amount, suffice it to say, the total amount of your income drives how much of your Social Security is taxable. That's a whole separate topic. I also have videos on that explain that formula. But the point is, some of your Social Security benefits will be specifically excluded from being taxable. Gifts and inheritance. If you receive a gift from someone, whether it's a parent, a friend, a relative, a random stranger in the street, gives you $2 or gives you $200,000 cash, that is not taxable to you, the gift recipient. Might potentially be taxable to the gift giver. Again, separate topic. Generally speaking, unless someone has gifted away over millions of dollars in their lifetime, not donations, but gifts to normal people, to non-charities, gifts are generally not taxable to the gift giver, and they're never taxable to the gift recipient. Inheritance as well. Now, asterisk on this one, if you inherit a pre-tax account like an IRA, distributions from that IRA will be taxable when you take them. But simply the act of receiving that IRA without yet taking distributions is not taxable in and of itself. Additionally, if you receive non-qualified assets, like someone leaves you their bank account, someone leaves you their house, their car, their personal effects, those are not taxable to you, the heir of that property. Another separate angle here is the estate might be subject to an inheritance tax, depending which state you live in. At the federal level, there is no inheritance tax. There is an estate tax that may kick in. But at the state level, states may have an inheritance tax and or an estate tax. So you probably figured this out by now, but all these things that I'm talking about, there's always exceptions and exceptions to exceptions. So I'm speaking in very, very general terms here, just to give a super basic overview. Don't take all this stuff for 100% fact or applicable to you, because there can always potentially be twists and turns and slight differences to these that apply to you and in your specific circumstances. But in general terms is what this podcast episode's about. All right, next, life insurance proceeds. If someone dies and has a life insurance policy and name you as the beneficiary of that policy, whether it's $100,000 or $10 million, those life insurance proceeds you get are not taxable to you, the recipient, specifically excluded from being taxable income. Tax-deferred retirement plan contributions. For example, you work at a company that has a 401k and you contribute $10,000 to it into the pre-tax traditional 401k. The $10,000 you contributed is not taxable income to you. It is specifically excluded from being taxed. Workers' compensation benefits, if you receive them, are excluded from income taxation, as are certain other employee benefits. And this all depends where you work, what kind of benefits they have, but some sort of ancillary benefits are not deemed taxable to you, like fringe benefit type things may not be taxable to you. This is one that depends. I don't want to dig into that. This is a separate rabbit hole. Another big one that often applies that many people may experience is gains on the sale of your primary residence. Specifically for single, you can exclude potentially up to $250,000 of gains on selling a primary residence. Or if you're married and file a joint return, you can exclude up to potentially $500,000 of gain on the sale of your residence. And there's some conditions you need to meet, like you need to have owned and lived in the house for at least 2 out of the last 5 years prior to the date of sale. But this is a good, impactful, important exclusion from income that many people end up taking advantage of. So now you start with all of your items of income, you strip out your exclusions that I just mentioned, and there's others, but these are sort of the more common ones. That then ends up being your, let's just call it gross income or total income. I'm reluctant to use these terms because they all sort of have their own special unique meaning and definition within the 1040. So I'm just sort of speaking generically when I use a lot of the terms tonight, but let's just call it gross income for now. So that's your gross income. And then from that, you then strip out or reduce it by adjustments to income. Or maybe you add, there are some additions to income you may add. But some of the common adjustments that reduce it are, for example, expenses associated with the business or losses on the sale of certain property is able to reduce your gross income. Educator expenses, if you're a teacher and you pay for supplies for the classroom, for example, out of pocket, unreimbursed from your employer, some of that is will reduce your income. If you have a health savings account, you can contribute to that. Contributions to that can reduce your gross income. If you're self-employed and have to pay self-employment taxes, which are the Social Security and Medicare payroll taxes, some of that can reduce your income. If you're self-employed and make contributions to a retirement plan, some of that can help reduce your income. You make contributions to a traditional IRA, that may be able to reduce your income. If you pay student loan interest, that may be able to reduce your income. So these are all adjustments to income that can help reduce your gross income. That then ultimately results in what's called your adjusted gross income, or AGI, which is a formally defined term on the tax return. If you're interested in seeing it, it's line 11 specifically on the 2021 and 2022 1040. That's a biggie. Now, I glossed over a lot. If you're actually looking at the 1040, you'll see there's multiple rows that I just kind of bounced over in getting to what I got to here. But again, I'm trying to keep this at a super high level. So now we have your adjusted gross income. That is not yet what you ultimately pay tax on. Against your adjusted gross income, you then are able to back out some deductions, specifically the greater of either what's called the standard deduction or itemized deductions. So standard deductions, as the name implies, is everyone can get it. It's standard. You don't have to do anything but show up, and you are eligible to reduce your gross income by the amount of a standard deduction. For example, if you are single in 2022, your standard deduction is $12,950, plus potentially more if you are over 65 and or disabled or blind by the end of 2022. For 2023, it increases. The single standard deduction is going to be $13,850, plus again, an extra amount you can tack on if you are over 65 or blind or disabled by the end of 2023. If you're married, file a joint return, it's simply double those amounts. $25,900 is the married standard deduction for 2022. For 2023, it goes up to $27,700. Again, plus some extras if you are over 65 or blind or disabled. So that's your standard deduction. That, again, you can deduct off your gross income just for being. Or if your itemized deductions end up being larger than your standard deduction, you can instead reduce your gross income by your itemized deductions. Now, I forget the statistic, but I think 90% of taxpayers in the U.S., roughly 90%, end up using the standard deduction because it's ultimately higher than what the sum of their itemized deductions would be. But for some people, itemized deductions still end up being higher. So as its name implies, itemized deductions are, there's a bunch of individual different deductions you can separately add up. You can add them all together. If the sum of those itemized deductions is larger than your standard deduction, then that is what you will use to reduce your gross income as we step through this tax return process. The common potential itemized deductions are unreimbursed medical or dental expenses, but only those that are in excess of 7.5% of your adjusted gross income or AGI. So many people don't really hit that unless you have unusually large medical expenses. Or what's called SALT taxes, S-A-L-T, state and local taxes. That is things like state income tax, property tax you pay in your home. Those are two biggies. Some personal property taxes. In some states, you pay a tax based on the value of your car, for example. That would be a state and local tax that's potentially deductible. Under current legislation, you can only deduct up to $10,000 in aggregate of state and local taxes. So this has been a hot button issue since 2018 when the rules changed around this and put in this $10,000 cap, especially for the high tax states like many of those on the coast where property taxes alone could easily blow through $10,000 a year. Add to that state income tax, which could be 10 or tens of thousands of dollars a year. And people could easily have $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 of state and local taxes all said and done. But they're capped at only deducting up to $10,000 currently. Home mortgage interest. If you have a mortgage in your primary residence, you could potentially deduct the interest you pay on that. Investment interest. If you have a regular brokerage account and you take a loan out of that account collateralized by your positions, your securities in that account, the interest you pay on that loan could be deductible. Charitable donations. If you donate to charity, whether it's cash or even physical property or even mileage driving to a charitable event or charitable, donating your time, that's all potentially deductible. Now the value of your time isn't deductible, but the driving to volunteer your time is that mileage is potentially deductible. And also casualty and theft losses from a federally declared disaster. So, if a hurricane or a storm knocks down your house and it's not reimbursed by insurance, isn't necessarily deductible unless that storm is part of a federally declared disaster, like a hurricane where, the government sweeps in and says, okay, this whole state or this whole county is a federal disaster area. Then any losses you have above and beyond what you get reimbursed from insurance is potentially deductible. So add all these various itemized deductions up. If that value exceeds your standard deduction, then it would be your itemized deductions that you reduce your gross income by in this tax return process. Otherwise, you simply take the standard deduction, which again, everyone gets just for being alive and just for showing up and doing a tax return. So now after you deduct either your standard deduction or your itemized deductions, we arrive at what I'll call taxable income. And this also is a line, a defined line on the tax return, specifically line 15 for 2021 and 2022. But wait, we're not done. There's more to it. Now, the taxable income is what you run through the federal marginal tax brackets. So what does it mean when I say marginal tax brackets? Currently, there are seven tax brackets for federal taxation. They start at 10%, and then 12%, 22%, 24%, 32%, 35%, 37%. And it's called marginal because not all of your income is taxed at 10, at 12, at 22, at 24. Certain amounts of dollars are taxed at 10%. The next slug of dollars is taxed at 12. The next chunk of dollars is taxed at 22. The next blob of dollars is taxed at 24. I'm running out of terms for blobs and chunks, so otherwise I'd keep going and talk about the rest of these brackets. But the point's the same. So you have your taxable income. Let's just assume it's $100,000, for example. This is what you run through the tax bracket. So for 2022, for example, if you are single, the first $10,275 of income is all taxed at 10%. The next dollars, so $10,276 of taxable income up to $41,775 is taxed at 12. And then the next dollar beyond that up to $89,075 is taxed at 22, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all the way up to once you hit 37%, everything beyond that's taxed at 37% federally. So that's the marginal system. Again, if you are $1 over one of those thresholds I just mentioned, it's not that all of your taxable income is now at that rate. It's just the next dollar, you know, the next few dollars or whatever are at that marginal rate of 22 or 24 or 32 or whatever it may be. So people often worry about, man, I'm $1 over the bracket. You know, does that mean all my income's taxed at the higher level? No, it's just that next dollar, you know, the incremental dollar after that. All the dollars before it were still taxed at 10 or 12 or 22 or whatever. And for 2023, the brackets are all higher. These are inflation adjusted every year. For 2023, all these brackets are higher by 7%, which is a nice little win. It's one of the silver linings of high inflation is the dollar amount of income at which these tax brackets start and stop all go up by that much more. So for a given dollar of income in 2023 versus 2022, you'll pay less tax in 2023 on it because of these higher tax brackets, thanks to inflate, you know, the 7% inflation that's applied to these brackets. So slight little win if you want to think about it that way. Now, big caveat here. Again, there's always exceptions to exceptions. I just said that you take your taxable income, which again was your adjusted gross income minus your standard itemized deduction is your taxable income. You run that through the tax brackets and that's your tax amount. Not that simple. If you have long-term capital gains, so for example, you sold a stock or a bond or a mutual fund in a regular brokerage account, you sold it after a year of when you bought it and you sold it at a gain, that gain is taxed at a lower rate. It's not your normal income tax brackets. It's either 0 or 15 or 20%. Same thing with certain dividends you receive in regular brokerage accounts. Those are taxed at the same 0 or 15 or 20%, not at your normal income tax rates of 10 or 12 or 22 or 24, et cetera, et cetera. So those are sort of carved out. They are included. Those gains and those dividends are included in your taxable income, but they're carved out and run through a separate calculation. So they're stripped out and run through either 0, 15, or 20%. Tax rates, the rest of your income, aka ordinary income, is what's then run through the tax brackets I discussed of 10, 12, 22, 24, 32, 35, 37%. Still with me? Confusing stuff, right? Such as the US tax code, it is a beast. It's Frankenstein-like. It's bolted onto. There's always, not always, but there's often sweeping legislation and changes. Rarely are things done to simplify it. It really just, it's always sort of tweaks to tweaks to tweaks and bolting on new codes and changes, which makes it really clunky and hard and convoluted to try to follow many times. Anyway, done with that sidebar. So you have your taxable income, you run that through the tax brackets, stripping out the long-term capital gains or qualified dividends, like I mentioned, because they're taxed separately. You add up the tax amounts that you get from your tax brackets plus any tax on those capital gains or dividends. And that is what I will call your tentative tax amount. But wait, that's not it. That is not your final tax obligation from the year. Against that, you are allowed to reduce it by certain tax credits. There's also things that can add to it. Like if you're self-employed, you would add to that self-employment tax, like the Social Security and Medicare taxes you have to pay. There's also something called the net investment income tax that I did a video on and a separate podcast episode on, which is some of those capital gains and dividends and even bank interest and other passive income may be subject to an additional 3.8% flat tax if your gross income is over a certain level. So like I said, always exceptions and twists and turns to this stuff. So I'm trying to keep this as stripped down and basic as possible for today's episode. So anyway, so again, you have your tentative tax amount, but that's not your final obligation for the year necessarily. You are allowed to strip out from that certain tax credits. Tax credits are things that reduce your tax obligation dollar for dollar. And there are two sort of broad classifications of tax credits, refundable and non-refundable. Refundable tax credits mean they can actually reduce your tax obligation below zero such that it's a negative. And if it's negative, that means the government will give you money back, you know, give you a tax refund. There are a few refundable ones. One is the earned income credit, which is if you are employed and have relatively low income, you are potentially able to get this earned income credit, which again is a refundable tax credit. It can reduce your tax obligation below zero, such that you get a refund and the government actually pays you tax, if you want to think about it that way. They're not paying you tax, but they're I don't know the best way to explain it. They're ultimately, you're paying negative tax, which means the government's paying you for the year. So they're not quite paying you tax, but they are paying you. Next is a child tax credit. If you have dependent children below a certain age, you are eligible to get a credit for them that reduces your tax obligation dollar for dollar. The American Opportunity Credit, which is an education credit, a credit used to pay for certain higher education expenses, that credit can reduce your tax obligation below zero because it is quote unquote refundable. And then next are non-refundable credits, of which there's a handful, some of the more common ones. Oh, so what does non-refundable mean? Non-refundable means it can reduce your tax obligation, but can't make it less than zero. Meaning even if this credit is you know, boatloads large, it can't make your tax obligation less than zero, meaning the government is going to end up paying you money as a result of you having large credits that reduce your tax obligation, because the lowest they can make it is zero. Meaning you don't owe any tax. You're not going to get anything from the government, but you also don't owe any tax necessarily. That's non-refundable. It can't reduce it below zero. Some of the non-refundable credits are foreign tax credit. If you paid taxes, like you have a brokerage account that owns some international stocks, and there are some automatic tax withholdings paid to foreign jurisdictions on, for example, dividends received on those stocks, you can get a credit for those taxes withheld for the foreign jurisdictions throughout the year. That credit can reduce your tax obligation here in the U.S. There's a credit for child and dependent care expenses. If you have a child and you're paying dependent care expenses, you can get some credit for that. There's other education credits, not the American Opportunity Credit, like I said, but there's something called the Lifetime Learning Credit, for example. Another credit where used for certain education expenses can reduce your tax obligation. Retirement Savings Contribution Credits. There's certain credits you may be eligible for if you do make contributions to certain retirement plans. Now, a lot of these credits have various income thresholds where you can get phased out. If your income's too high, you're not eligible to get some or any of these credits in certain cases. They all have their own unique twists and turns, but that's why I'm saying lots of sort of soft speak, like generally and potentially and possible, because these things really all depend on you and your specific circumstances every year. Residential energy efficiency improvements credits. If you get energy efficient windows or siding, siding, or you add insulation to your house, or high efficiency washer, dryer, hot water heater, whatever it may be, you can get credits for that. Qualified adoption expenses. You can also get a credit for certain adoption expenses. So now, starting from the top, you have all of your items and income. You exclude those specifically carved out from being taxable. That's your gross income. You reduce that by your adjustments to income. You arrive at your adjusted gross income, or AGI. Subtract from that your standard deduction or itemized deduction. That's your taxable income. Run that through the marginal tax brackets, but stripping out the long-term capital gains and qualified dividends. That then is your tentative tax amount. Reduce from that your tax credits. To the extent you have refundable credits that are larger than your tentative tax amount, you will end up getting money back from the government. You will not owe any tax. Or if they're non-refundable, they can reduce it potentially to zero, but no less. So after the stripping out the impact of these credits, that is your final tax amount. And that is what I'll call your total tax obligation for the year. Clear as mud, right? Not really. So with that in mind, that's what you're going to owe for the year in tax, net of all these deductions and adjustments and credits and whatnot. How do you pay that? Like I said at the beginning, the federal tax system is what's called a pay-as-you-go system, meaning the intention and expectation of the government is as you earn or otherwise realize taxable income, you are expected to pay tax on it at the time, ideally in the quarter in which you receive that income. That's when you should be paying the tax. Now, more complicated than that, I have a video I did that explains this much better. It's a whole other topic that requires its own flow charts and graphs and whatnot. I'll share a link to that in the notes. Definitely check that out if you're interested in more about paying taxes and avoiding underpayment penalties. But there are basically two ways to pay tax. One is through withholdings, where you have tax automatically stripped out of some sources of income and sent straight away to the U.S. Department of Treasury. The other is making estimated payments. Withholdings, there's only a handful of sources from which you can have taxes withheld. One is wages. For all of you who work for someone else, this is probably what you do. You get a paycheck every week, every 2 weeks, every month, whatever. Against that paycheck or out of that paycheck, some tax is withheld and sent straight away to the federal government and or the state government. that's you paying tax. That's you paying as you go, plain and simple. You know, as you're getting the money every pay period, some of it's carved off, sent to the government, quote unquote, pay as you go. So wages is one. Social Security is one. If you have a pension, that's one. If you have an annuity, that's one. If you have, I'm drawing a blank. There's only a few here. It'll come to me maybe, but those are the biggies for many people. Man, this is going to bother me. I feel like there's another big one I'm missing, but whatever. I digress. I'll move on. So those are some of the more common sources from which you can have taxes withheld directly and sent straight away to the taxing authority. Or estimated payments is where you have to consciously send a payment to the IRS, well, technically Department of Treasury, by check or through their website is cleaner and easier, where you do like an electronic bank transfer. You can pay by credit card. There's a surcharge for that, I believe. You can do it that way. Like I said before, the intention is pay as you go. You're supposed to be paying taxes in the quarter in which you earn or realize the income, which could often be difficult to do, especially if you have lumpy and unknown income for the year. You don't exactly know when you're supposed to pay until kind of after the fact. Withholdings, paying tax to withholdings is cleaner, easier, safer in most cases, because withholdings, regardless when in the year they're made, it's treated as if they were paid equally throughout the year, which best addresses the pay-as-you-go concept. Whereas with estimated payments, if you can do some good planning and actually get a reasonably close estimate of what your total tax obligation is for the year, then yes, then you can make estimated payments and just break that total annual amount up into four and make four payments in each of the four tax quarters and you're good. But what if you can't predict your income very well? Again, you get lumpy, unknown income. Then you kind of have to pay it as it happens each quarter. Now, there's some ways. If you don't, you may be subject to an underpayment penalty. Or if you don't pay enough throughout the year, either through withholdings or estimated taxes, there may be an underpayment penalty. Again, separate topic. Check the link to the video about that for more information. And there's ways around it. Ways around it sounds bad, but there's processes. If you do have lumpy unknown income, there's a process whereby you can quote unquote annualize your income to tick and tie the realization of income with when you made payments. If you're not able to estimate for the whole year and pay it in, you know, four equal neat and pretty estimated payments. All right, I think that's all I wanted to talk about for now. There can be weeks and weeks and weeks worth of topics drilling into specifics of tax things like the net investment income tax. I did a whole episode just on that, whereas today I glossed over it in about 7 seconds. It's that extra 3.8% flat tax that may apply on certain passive income. So today was just, I wanted to try to keep it as intro, as you know, one-on-one level as I could. I'm sure I probably got more technical than most people preferred, but it's really easy to get tripped up and go down a rabbit hole with some of these things, especially once I get riffing. But I will stop it here for today. I think that's sufficient for this intro on federal tax returns. Hopefully you found it helpful. Again, check out the video, which there'll be a link to if you want to see this in video form with a little more explanation, sort of, you know, graphical depiction of things might make it easier to digest. So that's that. If you do enjoy this podcast, as always, I would greatly appreciate a review, a thumbs up, a like, a click, a heart or whatever on whatever podcast platform you use to listen to this show. And if you do enjoy and value and learn from the stuff here, you will also like my other content sources. My Facebook group is Taxes and Retirement. My YouTube channel is Retirement Planning Demystified. And my monthly newsletter is Retirement Planning Insights. You can find links to all three of those in the notes to this episode. That is it. Next week will be another Q&A edition. If you have any questions you like answered on the show, send me an email to andypanko@gmail.com. That is A-N-D-Y-P as in Peter, A-N-K-O@gmail.com. And I will do my best to get that answered on next week's episode. That's it. Thank you as always for listening, and I will see you next time. Wait a second. Not over. Me again. Sorry about that. I just thought of something after I stopped recording last time, so I'll just tack this on the end and hope it's going to be clunky, but whatever. Good enough. I forgot to mention that your total tax obligation for the year is what, you know, in total, what you're expected to pay for the year. Throughout the year, you'll make tax payments through withholdings or estimated payments. To the extent you underpay in total those withholdings and estimated payments relative to what your total tax obligation is, it gets trued up at tax return time when you file your return, you know, the following spring. Any shortfall in tax, between what your obligation was for the year versus what you actually paid, that's when you owe extra money with your return. Or on the flip side, if you overpaid between withholdings and or estimated payments relative to what your total obligation was for the year, that's when you end up getting a refund. So just important to know that a refund isn't like, yeah, you know, I did good necessarily. No, it just simply means you paid more tax than you should have throughout the year, which isn't necessarily bad. Some folks will say you should never do that. You should always try to hit it right on zero or owe them something. You know, why give the government an interest-free loan? Which conceptually true on the surface. I mean, I don't personally get that hung up on it. If you're only overpaying by a few $100, $1,000, whatever, getting a refund for that much isn't going to make or break you. It's not the end of the world. If you overpaid by tens of thousands of dollars, yeah, you know, that's not ideal. You should probably tighten up your projections for the following year. But that's what that means. So when people end up like owing $1,000 with their tax return and be like, man, how do I owe $1,000? Well, all that simply means was you didn't pay enough throughout the year. It's not good. It's not bad necessarily. It's just, you know, it is what it is. It all washes out in the end and you reconcile the total year's payments versus obligation when you do your return. So getting a refund or having to owe extra with your tax return isn't inherently bad, isn't a sign in and of anything itself necessarily, unless it's really large, which means you overpaid or underpaid by a lot. It's just simply the cleaning up process. Even the best dialed in tax projection throughout the year, it's often difficult to nail this to the dollar, what your actual tax obligation is going to be, because there's some stuff that always sort of changes: dividends, interest, capital gain distributions in the mutual funds, whatever. You may get some surprise income you weren't counting on. It's hard to get to the dollar accurate tax projections and estimates for the year. You want to try to get close, but anyway. So point is, it all sort of reconciles and cleans itself up with the tax return at the end of the year by paying extra if you have to because you didn't pay enough throughout the year, or getting a refund if you overpaid throughout the year. So that's that. Just want to leave that comment there. Again, sorry, I forgot about it until after the fact. Silly me. I should have made better notes for this episode, I guess. But that's all. Again, thank you as always for listening, and I will see you next week.
The information discussed in this podcast is only general explanations and education. It is not specific tax, legal, or investment advice. Before considering acting on anything you heard here, first consult with your tax, legal, or investment advisor. Thank you.